Okay, so now moving to dynamic risk management, so agenda paper 5, and I think I'm handing over to Andrew.
Many thanks. Last time I presented this material, it was actually an optional session, but you folks get no choice. Now, thank you for the opportunity to share our findings and our thoughts from some research we undertook in 2016, which is very much intended to be a helpful contribution to the ISB's ongoing work on dynamic risk management, or macro hedging, I might call it interchangeably. And you have in your meeting papers our 50-page report, which is here in glorious Technicolor, and also a rather shorter high-level presentation. And I will confine my comments very much to the high-level presentation and take this as a... I'll assume you'll have read this at a level of detail commensurate with your interest in the subject. So, first of all, to set some context. From a European point of view, at least the deemed lack of an acceptable approach to macro hedging in originally IAS 39 was a controversial issue right from the birth of the IFRS project, IAS project in Europe, and led to a carve-out, the other type of carve-out, back in 2004. There were actually two carve-outs to IAS 39, but one of them's received into distant memory and been resolved. It was resolved quite quickly. Both were intended to be temporary, but here we are 13 years later, and the IAS 39 carve-out is still with us. IAS 39's hedge accounting model, and therefore in Europe, the IAS 39 carve-out as well, will still be with us in the IFRS 9 world, because, of course, IFRS 9 gives companies the accounting policy choice to stick with the IAS 39 hedge accounting rules. A number of banks in Europe make use of the carve-out. Probably, I don't have a precise number, probably the majority do not. But I don't think that in any way should be taken as diminishing the scale of the issue. What the majority of banks seem to do is work within the IAS 39 hedge accounting rules, but make very extensive use of so-called proxy hedges. So in simple terms, that means what they're doing is one thing for internal risk management purposes, but then they're finding some other hedge accounting relationships that actually qualify under the IAS 39 rules and designating those to try and economically depict what they believe they're doing from a risk management point of view. But that creates, quoting from one of the ISB's own staff papers, a sort of black box phenomenon rather than actually portray the effects of risk management based on what's actually happening. Some alternative designations are found to comply with the rules, and that surely cannot be a good thing. And more generally, for all the IFRS community in Europe and beyond, I understand that until there is a macro hedge solution, we're still going to have two hedge accounting models out there, the IAS 39 and IFRS 9 models, and that can hardly be a good thing, hardly be a long-term sustainable approach. So I think we do have a shared interest in finding a new way forward with macro hedge accounting, and therefore very encouraged that the project appears to be, perhaps it never stopped, but appears to be going into a more dynamic phase, if I could put it that way. And I believe there's an education session for the ISB board at the March meeting. So that's the context, what we are trying to do. I'll just briefly cover our objective at a high level, what we found, and then some just personal reflections on what it might imply for the way forward with this project. So if we turn to slide 4 on purpose of the outreach, the evolution from the IAS 39 hedge accounting model to the IFRS 9 model is largely about trying to bridge the divide between risk management practice and the hedge accounting rules, and I think IFRS 9 does a very, very nice job of that. It takes us a long way. But there isn't a comprehensive macro hedging solution, so certainly in the context of banks, that divide remains and still needs to be bridged. So what we wanted to do, if we're going to try and bridge the divide between the hedge accounting rules and risk management practice, we wanted to understand in more detail what risk management practice actually is. We did focus on banks. We know that Of course, it's not only banks that have an interest in a macro hedging solution. We certainly heard this is an issue in the insurance sector. This can be an issue in the energy sector. But possibly banks present the most complex and challenging breadth of this bridge divide to be spanned. So we thought we'd start off there. We have to start somewhere. And actually, our focus was even narrower than that. We just have to focus solely on interest rate management, and indeed, one aspect of interest rate management, risk management, which is the modelling of so-called structural balances, of which more in a moment. We picked a sample of 15 banks. We asked them to complete quite detailed questionnaires. We followed that up with structured interviews by video conference. And as I mentioned, this is intended very much as a contribution to the IASB's ongoing work. So I'm pleased to say that the IASB project team or members thereof participated as observers throughout the process. The banks in our sample had balance sheet totals around 15 billion euros, of which just over 40% was represented by customer deposits. So moving on to slide five, at a very high level, what did we find out? Well, the first point I'd make is that in managing their interest rate risk, what we heard banks are trying to do is stabilise their net interest margin, the difference between their interest income and interest expense. They do not want to be too exposed to short-term interest rate movements. So typically what we found is they are, as a management choice, trying to identify some longer-term moving average interest rate and make sure their net interest margin tracks that long-term moving average interest rate within certain sensitivities, within certain risk tolerances. Of course, that wouldn't really be a problem if banks, for example, funded every five-year loan with a five-year liability with the same interest rate basis, same tenor, etc. But that's not how banks work. Banks are in the business of liquidity transformation, to some extent, entering into using customer deposits that are repayable on demand or in the very short term to fund longer-term lending activity. So, again, generalising across what we found, what banks are doing is modelling their interest rate sensitivity based on time periods. They're taking interest-sensitive assets and interest-sensitive liabilities, scheduling those into time buckets, seems to be the chosen terminology, based on when they mature or when they reprice. Having done that modelling, they can then estimate the sensitivity of interest income and expense within those time buckets to interest rate movements and use interest rate swaps, interest rates options and swaptions to try and close the gap, reduce the sensitivity within their defined risk tolerances. That's at a very high level what's happening. And that modelling very much includes so-called structural balances. So these include customer deposits that are repayable typically on demand, and in many cases also include equity. And you know, I'm, by my own confession, I am not an expert at all in this aspect of banks' risk management. So it took me a little bit of time to try to understand how that could make sense, given that customer deposits, certainly in today's environment and the economies I'm more familiar with, are not typically interest-bearing. And equity, of course, is certainly not interest-bearing. If I've understood it properly, what matters isn't the fact that these balances do not directly bear interest. What matters is that these are that banks in entering into loans, in creating, originating assets, those assets have to be funded. They're funded by a mixture of their customer deposits, by equity balances, and by other liabilities. And in scheduling out by time bucket, like which assets are funded by which liabilities, that's what creates the interest sensitivity based on these time periods, based on these time buckets. So putting it very simply, it's not the fact that core deposits and equity do not bear interest that matters, it's the fact that they'll be available for a certain amount of time and therefore can be considered to fund certain assets, which affects the overall sensitivity to shorter term interest rate movements. So far so good. Just back on this point about the objective being to stabilise the net interest margin. We go back to the 2014 discussion paper, which explored a model known as the portfolio revaluation approach. That was a sort of take the risk managed portfolio and fair value it to the extent of movements in the designated risk, the designated interest rate risk. So it's not a full fair value model, but it's a full model in the context of the whole portfolio gets revalued, then it gets revalued for a particular risk. Now, certainly EFRAG, and I understand much of the bank preparer community around the world, was not very supportive of that model. And there are two main reasons. Firstly, from EFRAG point of view, that model in advocating this full fair value for a particular risk approach is effectively overriding IFRS 9 and overriding its use of amortised cost for the banking book to a large extent, whereas amortised cost was considered to provide useful information in the development of IFRS 9. But secondly, what that model does is actually change the accounting for what you're not hedging as well as for what you are hedging, and therefore will actually in some cases increase volatility rather than reduce it. So banks think from a business model point of view they are stabilising their interest margin, and the PRA accounting model would actually increase volatility in some situations. So the discussion paper was an extremely useful contribution. I think showed a very high level of awareness of the issue and also of risk management practices in the real world. But we're not sure, not at all convinced, that this PRA is the right way forward for the next stage of development of the project. So thus far I've described a common ground around what we found in our sample. But moving on to the slide on modelling demand deposits and indeed modelling equity, we started finding lots of differences. So in modelling demand deposits, one thing banks need to do is distinguish their so-called core deposits, so those they expect to be available on a longer term basis, from those demand deposits that might just walk out of the door tomorrow. So distinguish the stickier from the non-stickier portions, if I can put it that way. They all need to do that, but they've got very different ways of making that allocation. We looked at how far out into the future banks are doing their modelling, and the range was, we found in our samples, between 3 years and 15 years. The time span of each time bucket differed greatly. There were differences around whether banks are purely modelling their existing portfolio of deposits or actually also factoring in replacement production or new production. Moving on to modelling equity. Just over half of the banks in our sample explicitly include equity in their modelling. If you wanted to argue that some of the other banks were sort of implicitly modelling equity, but I won't go there. So that's one area of difference. Some do, some don't model equity. Those that do, they have different definitions of equity, which, surprise, surprise, don't always exactly mirror the IAS 32 definition. Some will assume that the first slice of equity finances things like property, plant and equipment. So it's equity less PP&E, for example, that might then be fed into the model. So overall, again, a wide range of differences. So just moving on to implications for an accounting solution. These are EFRAG secretariat level reflections. If the goal is to try and, to repeat myself, to bridge this divide between risk management practice and the accounting rules, I'd suggest there are probably three things that are fundamental for the solution to gain sufficient acceptance. First of all, the model has to reflect the dynamic nature of risk management practice. The hedge accounting rules in both IAS 39 and IFRS 9 do depend on basically a static designation. You identify the hedged items, you identify the hedging instruments, the rules have changed on what can be a hedged item and whether it could be a group of items or a net position, but all the same, you've got to identify what you're hedging, identify the hedging instrument, you've got to document that. And although IFRS 9 introduces a concept of rebalancing, which means you can change the amount of the hedging instrument or change the amount of the hedged item, that's still within the context of the relationship you originally documented and designated. I mean, risk management in this sector, from what we looked at, just doesn't work like that. What in effect banks are doing is saying, well, what we want to do is not hedge particular instruments or even particular cash flows, we want to hedge a particular amount of risk. But in that their modelling is trying to identify interest rate sensitivity, in other words, an amount of risk by time bucket, and then reduce that within defined parameters. So that has to somehow come across in the hedge accounting model, would suggest. I think I've covered this already, but what's being hedged is a net amount of risk, a net position. So, you know, IFRS 9 goes a long way towards, like, loosening the shackles from hedging only gross positions to hedging net positions, but it doesn't actually encompass core deposits, certainly doesn't encompass equity. And what banks are doing in their modelling is often referred to as behavioralisation. So from an accounting point of view, then core deposits are accounted for at their face value. In effect, there is no measurement. They're accounted for as though they are going to walk out of the door tomorrow. That's not how they behave economically, and that's not how banks incorporate them into their modelling. They split them into these core and non-core parts and then allocate the core part into time buckets based on expected maturities. Not always, by the way, to the full extent of their expected maturity. They're not going out all the way into infinity. There are some management choices about how far they look out. So, dynamic net positions, behavioralisation, particularly for core deposits, would seem to be fundamental to a macro hedging solution that would gain widespread acceptance, certainly in a European environment. But then there are going to be, we fully acknowledge, some difficult choices to be made at standard setting level, if that's not all difficult enough already. So one of those would be, can equity be incorporated into the model, and if so, how? Perhaps more generally, if we are looking at all this behavioralisation, potentially looking to rely more heavily on existing risk management models that vary in what they do in practice, and how can that all be reconciled with the, the established hedge accounting protocol or sacred cow, that hedge accounting is an exception and therefore needs to be subject to tightly defined disciplines so you can avoid opportunities for earnings management. It's probably going to be some trade-off in all of that. I'm not saying that's going to be easy, but that needs to be looked at. It's an established tenet of hedge accounting that effectiveness or ineffectiveness needs to be captured, measured, and reported in profit or loss. So actually finding some way to determine effectiveness in this behavioralized dynamic model, it is not going to be easy, and we certainly don't come equipped with the answers, but that maybe is at the heart of the search. So we put down a few questions for discussion, but open to any questions, comments or reactions. These are on slide 9. So be interested in any thoughts on, at a high level, the risk management practices that I've described. How similar or different are they to what you see in your own jurisdictions? To what extent should an accounting solution seek to reflect the variety of risk management practices? And I might slightly rephrase that question. Yeah, the portfolio revaluation approach was a very interesting attempt, I think, to capture dynamic risk management holistically, and that was what was set as the objective. In our comment letter on that discussion paper, we suggested that rather than try something quite so innovative, and innovation can be a good thing, that's trying to capture this whole variety of practices quite so comprehensively, why not see if we can just build on the existing hedge accounting rules in IFRS 9 to address the sort of issues that I've described. And we also ask what might seem like a strange question, but I think it is worthy of consideration, even if rather fleetingly. It says, should a macro hedge accounting solution be mandatory or optional? And I think most like we think of hedge accounting as being something that's optional because it overrides the normal accounting rules. But if you really can sort of reconcile the risk management world and the accounting world in a very useful way that wouldn't be operationally too complex, then you'd capture the business model or the risk management piece of it. So it is worth asking, should that then become mandatory in certain circumstances? So I'll throw that one out there, but welcome any questions or comments.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, first of all, I congratulate you because it's a very, 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 very good job in a very complex. I believe you reduce it to the main components. The only suggestion I would make to add to this description here is to include FX rates, because it's an important element to stabilize NII too. So it's everything you said plus FX risk. So my view. I like you use a very important word in my opinion here that defines everything here, is that risk is fungible for financial institutions. So it's like a currency, you know. It's a certain amount of exposition, you get a certain amount of, including bonuses are allocated on the amount of risk that each trader or each head is able to manage. So it's exactly, it's fungible. So it can be transferred from one unit to the other. And one thing that I like just to comment, I believe it is important, is the introduction of liquidity coverage ratios and NSFR, net stable funding ratios, will make this equation here a little bit more complicated. But having said that, I agree with you that IFRS 9 does not solve many of those problems here. So, and I personally do not agree, it's a personal opinion, that this should be made, this macro hedge instruction should be made optional, because you have an option to do hedge accounting or not to do hedge accounting. And if you decide to do hedge accounting, you have an option to do under IAS 39 or under IFRS 9. So they have three options for the same treatment. Mm-hmm. I believe it's going to make it very hard for investors to compare financial institutions, because one is not doing hedge account, the other one is doing a la IAS 39, the other one is doing in the IFRS 9 fashion. And reflection here is maybe we should think about a business model, kind of business model approach. How to treat derivatives, use it for head, depending on the business model of that institution, of that operation, because it's on the other hand, how to anticipate all the effects and how to create a model that adapts to this complexity here. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. So maybe if that institution use derivatives to hedge its portfolio, as a business model is that, maybe could account for it as a hedge. And if you do not use those derivatives in a business model approach for hedging, then you could not account for it. Mm-hmm. Because it's really thinking that from a very practical point of view, how do you write that rule? I don't see how to embrace this complexity here. Mm-hmm. So macro hedge approach, I believe, is not going to solve those problems.
Thank you.
Kumar, did you want to come in?
Just quickly, one question. Thanks a lot, Andrew. I appreciate the work, and we were part of it, and thanks for letting us be there. Just one question. When we were talking about it, you did mention that, absolutely agree that any kind of a solution, we need to look at core demand deposits. Mm. Because if you look at it, 14 out of the 15 banks are doing it.
Yep.
And the only bank that wasn't doing it, if I remember correctly, was because the regulators wouldn't let them do it. That was the reason. The question which I had for you is more to do with equity, because it's quite a thing. And it also links into your comment of how innovative we are going to be. Because some of the banks were including in that equity balances provisions for bad debt. Mm-hmm. So when I take that to the next level, is that how innovative we are going to be is to revalue provisions for interest rate. So my question which came up is that, yes, absolutely agree about core demand deposit. Do you think equity is also that critical? Because also it's 8 out of the 15 banks who are doing some form because of the challenge of defining what that thing is.
Well, purely as a personal reaction, equity is going to be more difficult. It's not a controversial thing to say, equity is going to be more difficult to incorporate in any hedge accounting model that builds on the foundations of the IFRS 9 hedge accounting model. But I think if you talk to the banks, and those that include equity in their modelling will say it's fundamental, and those that don't will say something different. And that's about all I can share. The pros and cons need to be, well, challenges need to be examined. Sorry to duck the question someone, but we don't have a position.
That's okay.
Yukio?
Thank you. We appreciate the IFRAG's effort for undertaking the outreach and reporting the result in the paper. And we think information about the practices of European banks would be useful input to move the ISB's project forward. The IFRAG's paper indicates that there is a diversity in practice for the modeling of core demand deposit.
Yeah.
Japanese banks also model core demand deposit, but similar to European banks, they are different when considering the details. Our understanding is that the objective of the dynamic risk management project is to address the difficulties applying existing hedge accounting requirement to open portfolios. Focusing on core demand deposit, which are considered difficult to apply hedge accounting, is consistent with this objective. So one question we have is about the scope of this project, that is, what the ISB views as other issues related to the hedge accounting for open portfolios. Finally, we believe any new macro hedge accounting model the ISB develops should be optional, so that it would be consistent with general hedge accounting. We are not aware of any significant concerns about optionality of existing accounting standard, and it may not be feasible to mandatorily require entities to apply macro hedge accounting when entities do not manage interest rate risk in a sophisticated manner.
We're talking about hedge accounting, but so far it hasn't actually been a hedge accounting project for the ISB, right?
Right, absolutely.
Because of the dynamic nature, right? So the portfolio revaluation approach was consciously not a hedge accounting solution. And obviously that's something that the staff will
come back with,
but just in terms of terminology.
And that is why, I mean, just to go back to that, if you look at the PRA, one of the things was that if you have open positions, that also give rise to risk. Mm-hmm. Just because you haven't hedged it doesn't mean the risk has gone away.
Yeah.
Agreed. That wasn't exactly the model which the industry loved or anything, but that is the focus of it.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that it couldn't be a hedge accounting project, but that wasn't the way that we initially approached it.
It's more of a brain.
Now, I'll go on this way. So, Andreas.
Thank you. I think the contrast of this session to the previous one on the conceptual framework shouldn't be any starker. Because if I think about hedge accounting, I always think about a rectification of something that went wrong in the first place. So the mere existence for hedge accounting requirements or options, if you wish, in 39 and IFRS 9 was there because we have a mixed measurement model.
Absolutely.
Have we gone for a single measurement model? There will be no necessity, basically. You could argue about cash flow hedge accounting, but that's probably a different story. So I think any project that deals with this issue has to make one fundamental decision right from the beginning. Should this be a rectification of an accounting artifact, or should this be should the objective be to faithfully portray what's happening in practice? If you went for the latter, I don't see any room for this being optional. It has to be mandatory.
Yeah.
And then obviously the problem is, will the accounting determine what banks could do or what entities could do in practice in managing risk? Because as we've heard, I mean, banks structure their balances differently. So would an accounting solution then say, this is okay, this is not okay? Question mark. So I see a number of challenges in addressing this issue, as we had with the PRA in the first place. But I think it is, as I see it, very important to make that fundamental decision fairly early on to say, is this really an accounting issue, or is this about faithful portrayal of what we want to do? And if we are fans of faithful representation, I just caution us, because I think it will probably do away with all the accounting conventions that we know. I mean, we could just start a new product on the conceptual framework.
Thank you for that, Andre.
Thank you, Andreas.
On here.
Thank you.
I think it's a very useful report, and this report will surely provide a sound basis for the ISV developer standard, and I also think that similar research from and as I didn't receive any specific comments from AUS members, I can just make some general comments regarding the questions put in the slides. Question one, major Korean banks say they manage their risks using the AAM technique. So I can say that their practices are similar to the European banks. And regarding question two, when we made comments on the DP in 2014, Korean banks favored limiting the macro hedging project to improving the existing standard IAS 39 to better reflect the interest rate hedging activities. They think that an attempt to reflect an entity's risk management activities fully in the face of the financial statements would involve a high level of judgment and subjectivity, because an entity's risk management activities heavily rely on the management's view of risk and risk objective. It will be very difficult to satisfy all the different objectives. So they would prefer an approach that the risk management activities are explained more in the note disclosures. Regarding question three, I think a new macro-hedging accounting solution should be optional. But having said that, this question could be better addressed when we have a more concrete model to discuss and when we have an objective of that model.
Awesome.
And a little bit what also Andreas has said, because I think it is a decision has to be taken in this project very early. Do we want to reflect risk management or not? If you want to reflect risk management, I think we are close to what we had discussed in our discussion paper, because we have to value that a little bit, and that is a kind of fair values at risk, and that was not liked by the industry. So what I think is, if we want to have built a model which is liked by the industry, we need a kind of reflection of the business model, but in an amortized cost environment, which is very, very difficult, and I think not possible. And therefore, I think it is not really a fully reflection of the risk management. It is kind of in between. But even if we do that and accept some kind of this dynamic risk management, what you said, Andrew, I think is very key, because man, if you don't reflect the dynamic nature of that, you should forget this project from the beginning. But also, I think, which is also key, I think if we don't reflect this dynamic risk management and don't accept certain elements, which, for example, is including equity, then it will clearly not reflect it, something else. But if we have all this kind of in, then I agree with Andreas, and we have forget all our accounting conventions. Mm-hmm. And therefore, really, it is a kind of the objective of this project now is very, very important, because otherwise we have the risk that we develop something fixed, great things, but which is not liked, which nobody wants. And therefore, I think it is very, very, I think, key that we have the objective of this project from the beginning and then answer these key questions.
how far we want to go. Do we want to go include core deposits? Do we want to include equity? Do we include whatever what you mentioned, and how far do we go? And we have to answer these questions very early. And if not, then we should forget this project. That's what I think.
Totally.
So there's one word in this report that really confuses me, and that's behavioralization, as it applies to core demand deposits and perhaps to equity, because it seems to me that it's being used in two different ways. One is observing the characteristics of some deposits and how sticky they are, what's core, what's non-core, what fluctuates, to what extent are they susceptible to interest rate movements. And from that, people say, well, I can model a core demand deposit as a fixed rate liability, and things stems from there. But I don't actually think that's what people really mean. And the clue is on page 32 of your report. When you talk about core demand deposit balances, and then said that banks generally referred to final maturity being determined on a management decision. And then you give a number of drivers, and one of them is stabilization of net interest income over interest cycle. By interest cycle, I sort of interpret that as management's view of the interest cycle. So when people talk about behavioralization, it isn't observing something and then coming to a conclusion, I behavioralize this as a five-year fixed rate deposit. Really, what people are doing is thinking about the way they want to manage their interest rate risk, their interest profile, what they want to achieve, and then they're imputing onto the deposits an answer to get them to that sort of interest rate profile. So I think it's talking about behavioralization is very confusing, and if there's one thing that I'd like to see done is more work on really what that means, because personally I don't view the answer to all of this as behavioralizing and creating some fixed rate liability out of core demand deposits. I think the solution is elsewhere, and when you try to apply it to equity it becomes even more ridiculous, because you can't behavioralize equity as a fixed rate deposit. It just isn't. What you do is you hypothecate the thing is a fixed rate deposit to justify the swaps that you are taking on to create the interest rate, net interest income profile that you want to achieve. So if you say, well, let's pretend that the equity is a five-year fixed rate liability, and then we do all of our swaps based upon that, we will, hey presto, at the end of the day, produce for the next 5 years fixed net interest income. But you decided in the first place that that's what you wanted to achieve, and you just sort of did this as a way of justifying it.
There's another explanation to this. I assume my equity is a perpetual bond, but I do not have perpetual derivatives, so I have to use the derivatives that I can use. So I'm not doing it after the fact. Understand the point.
Well, then your objective is to fix net interest income for as far out as you can go,
yes,
based upon what derivatives are available. But that's just another management decision. I might decide that I don't want to go out that far, but I'm happy to fix it on a rolling quarter. Exactly. There was another one in here about 60 rolling quarters and 20 rolling quarters and doing it on that basis. That's just a management decision.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying that maybe it is not a justification after the fact. I'm just trying to look for a theory to say that this is hedge. So it is genuine. People are doing 5 years swap because they cannot do 50 years swap. They do not exist.
I just don't think the answer to this is behavioralizing core demand deposits. It's a sideshow. The real issue is the net interest margin and risk management and what you're trying to achieve.
I mean, it's certainly clear that in this modeling practice there is a degree of management decision around how far out you look. I don't think banks are trying to make a best estimate of the exact behaviours of these so-called structural balances. But I think the concerns you raise are just part of how do you sort of impose some kind of effectiveness test around all of this.
I was going to ask you a question which sort of builds on what Steve has just said, but first of all, I wanted to say I think this is probably the simplest articulation of the issue I've seen anywhere. So I certainly appreciated it, and that's a compliment, because it's so hard to make it accessible for people to even enter the debate. So well done on that. The question I had, which sort of is linked to what Steve was just saying, was, and I don't know which banks were in the study and how diversely spread they were amongst Europe or how similar or different their businesses were, but if I just think about Europe is relatively diverse, I guess, but not as diverse as obviously the whole world by definition. But it was quite interesting, quite interesting to me that even within Europe we might have ended up with a situation where the different estimates range from 3 years to 15 years. Yeah. And what I wondered, I guess, was if you look at the different ways people think about it, some think about the liability behaviour, some think about the assets, some think about the derivatives, some think about the choices they're making in terms of what they want to achieve. Did you get a sense of whether the 3 to 15 years was because there was a different economic situation, or was it because they'd thought about how to make these assessments using different drivers, to use your terminology? So is this economic differences or just different outcomes because of the way they thought about it? Do you get a sense from your work?
It's a good question. I'm not sure we actually did in the end. We set our goal as fact-finding to try and, like I say, we're trying to bridge a divide from hedge accounting rules to risk management practice. Let's try and figure out the range of practice that's out there. It's a fair question. We can follow up with the team.
It might be interesting, because I think that would be an interesting fact, because if this is real economic differences, then I might feel about it one way. If actually the economic situation was identical, but one had come up with 3 years and one came up with 15 years, I might think about it in a different way. So that, to me, would be interesting.
I think it's just more about how far out banks are actually looking to stabilise their net interest margin.
Well, there is a mention here that five banks noted that the decision to stabilize net interest income was not linked at all to the maturities of assets.
I'd like to talk to these guys. And to know who they are, and to know who they are, to get away from that.
The other thing that I had flashbacks as I read this to my experiences from the PRA, I must say, was some of the reasons that we had challenges were sort of reinforced for me reading this work and knowing what the banks are doing. So, for example, the fact that it's so dynamic, which was what was one of our big challenges and why we didn't go with a hedge accounting solution firstly. So you confirmed that, which is helpful. Also the way that the banks think about effectiveness and the fact that the measure of their success is based on how they've set their risk parameters, as opposed to the way we would traditionally think about effectiveness, which I think is one of the sources of tension between our traditional hedge accounting thinking and the way that the banks think about portraying, and also just the challenge around this behavioralization. So, but it was very helpful to get some more colour in terms of what it is that's driving those challenges to help us, I think through what we might do. So interesting, helpful, thank you for doing that.
I'll be willing to expose my lack of understanding of some of these issues. And although, let me start by echoing Sue's comments about I found this a very helpful exposition of what the issues were, and a lot clearer. Great that you managed to explain it without a lot of jargon, which is something that when one gets into technical areas, is very often the refuge. Taken, so well done. And I think this may be echoing a bit of what Andreas was saying, that there seems to be an inconsistency in the arguments put forward to explain the need for a special model, which is there's a significant activity that is not being faithfully reflected in the financial statements, and that activity is risk management, with the approaches that are more the extension of the elective hedge accounting, rather than saying, if this is an important activity that currently is not being faithfully represented, presumably across the range of the way that people manage it, with entirely an objective of stabilizing, some mix of stabilizing and risk-taking for optimization, you would be accounting for the activity rather than trying to reflect in each period the dampening of volatility that is their objective. You know, so it's kind of like right now proxy hedging is criticized because it's not actually reflecting the relationships. But it's trying to get to that same kind of effect of identifying which reported volatility is sitting there, partly from a mismatch with amortized cost, but there's no appetite for leaving amortized cost. So if the argument is that risk management is such an important activity that it must be faithfully represented, I think you do, that argument supports more a PRA type approach without specifically that model, the accounting for the activity, you know, versus accounting for pieces of the mitigation activity. So that's a challenge in terms of how the arguments for doing something match up with any set of proposals. So, just an observation. The quest, you know, in now maybe anticipating some of the education that is Kumar's challenge to deliver over the, you know, the coming months. But the part at the beginning of the paper explaining why rates are averaged over time, I really struggled with relating that to both the risk management activity and some of the modeling. I mean, I understand the points about how demand deposits actually behave versus what the accounting requirements are, but I did not get the connection with moving average rates and why historical experiences of moving average rates, how they come into the understanding of this process. So that's a question. I don't know if there's a simple answer, or that's something that I struggled with, just an observation about what I struggled with in the paper and where I might appreciate a deeper understanding. Then shifting gears entirely, there's a third point, which is I'm going to point to the FICE project for a minute. And part of our discussions on liability equity classification have been focused on the demand for recognition of the total amount of claims that potentially could be made at any point in time. And that is what drove us to the, you know, what we've called very imaginatively the gamma approach that says, you know, either A or B gets you into liability classification. And one of the reasons is people want to see the claims recognized, not just disclosed, you know, which is what drives you away from, let's say, a net exposure for derivatives on own equity. This, if we incorporate any kind of behavioralization, will seem to be running directly into the conclusions that we're starting to explore, you know, the issues that we're starting to explore about what people want from financial statement recognition and measurement in terms of total amount of potential claims shown. So I think that's just another interaction that we're, you know, that we're going to have to think about.
Might depend how we present it, though.
Yeah.
Because if you still had the deposit as a
liability,
too much to see if he's going to hit me, as like the full 100, if you like, and then you had a separate item that was an adjustment factor, then that wouldn't.
Yeah, but it's just something to think about in terms of managing all the projects coming together to a single set of standards,
yeah,
rather than an independent land that you.
Only one short comment to Mary's first point on. And I don't think what banks don't want. They don't want to have reflected their interest rate risk management in accounting. What they want, because that was our approach with the first approach, valuation approach, because that approach reflected then the risks which were not mitigated and the risks which were mitigated. Mm-hmm. And banks want to have reflected the risk which is mitigated, but not showing the risk which is not mitigated.
Yeah. Right.
And that is a challenge. That is really the challenge, because that is what they want to have in hedge accounting, that, okay, this portion which they do hedges, which then mitigates, reduces risk. They don't want to have set then an accounting mismatch then, because if they're using derivatives, they don't have set
different revaluated and amortized cost book. But the reflection of risk management would clearly include, from my perspective, also showing open risk position. And that was our approach in the discussion paper. Mm-hmm. And that was not liked by banks.
Right. And all I'm...
Only want to make that...
I get that. And it's not that I was arguing that we should be doing that. I was just pointing out the inconsistency, at least superficially, the inconsistency between why does something need to be done at all? Answer, there's an important activity that's not being faithfully reflected.
That
if that's the rationale, then the answer seems to be then you should report faithfully the whole of that activity rather than selected bits. So it may be dampening down. It's just a logical inconsistency in terms of having made the argument that there's a problem. Then how you approach the solution.
That's the reason why available for sale securities with all that flexibility were so popular. You're mm-hmm. never going to see any bank complaining about the flexibility and available for sale securities. But that's the way to, as you mentioned, I put everything on that I want to show as a hedging on net income, and everything else will be classified as available for sale. That's an act, you know, by participation, right?
Sometimes it might be faithful representations in the eye of the beholder.
But what, back on the PRA, we'll say what we heard from our 15 banks, is they believe economically they are reducing volatility and want an accounting model which will portray that, and the PRA doesn't seem to do that.
That wasn't a, I want to keep with the PRA. That was just a, think carefully about how the argument is constructed.
And of course, hedge accounting, sacred cow number one, isn't even to do with hedge accounting. It's that derivatives are measured at fair value through profit or loss, which used to be the case in much of the Euro gap or national gap in different parts of Europe prior to IAS 39. So that's, I won't say that's the source of all the problems, that'll be rather pejorative, but that's the kind of starting point for why banks in Europe are concerned that IAS 39 introduced what they regard as artificial volatility. So to try and fix that problem by imposing a sort of more comprehensive fair value accounting solution that fair values things that you're not hedging as well as things that you are hedging hasn't proven to be a promising way forward from the point of view of the European banking industry. You could equally argue, why not have a amortized cost measurement for the risk managed portfolio, including derivatives, for example, or some form of amortized cost measurement. We flip to fair value.
Can somebody define for me what is the amortized cost of a derivative, Andrew? I'm yet to get a definition of that. How do I divide EIR for a swap?
It's a good question. Capture changes in expected cash flows when it's done properly.
Well, that would bring it to within...
discount at the original effective interest rate.
With a catch-up, I think you'll be very near fair value with that one.
You're right. Haven't run the maths.
Okay.